This is the 3D Pod, your number one source for 3D printing news, analysis, and insight from 3DPrint.com. Now, here are your hosts, Joris Peels and Maxwell Bogue.
Hi, everyone. My name's Joris Peels, and this is another episode of the 3D Pod. And with me today is, well, not Max. Max is at a toy fair in Germany, so sadly he can't make it at the moment. So I'm going to have to wing it, do this one by myself. So apologies for that, guys. But we're going to try and push on ahead with our guest, and that's Ollie Tamanjani. He's a professor at aeronautical engineering at Emory-Riddle Aeronautical University. And before that, he was at Virginia Tech. He was a postdoc at Virginia Tech Aerospace in oceaneering initially. And then, well, at one point, well, you think, you know, you're a professor, just lean back, you know, settle in, try to get tenure and hang in there. Nope. Ollie decides he wants to start a company. And so he started Novaneer. And Novaneer is, well, it's a way to do something that is so blindingly obvious that no one else did it. So it's one of those like brilliant, blindingly obvious things where, well, normally what we do is we design a part, right? Then we maybe go to do FEA or some kind of simulation, and we could redesign that part. Now, once we're happy with it, then we then make a tool path to put it in the 3D printer. These are all usually, you know, then you could use a whole bunch of different software for this. And what Ollie really came up with is a way to say, you know what, the optimization of that part and the projection or the simulation of that part, plus that tool pathing is so important and affects that part so much that, well, that we should really be doing this in a separate software package that can do that much faster, much better. So that's what Novaneer is. So I think that's really exciting as well. Ollie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Joris, for having me. And thank you also for the introduction.
All right, awesome, awesome. So first off, like, the first question kind of always here is like, when did you get in touch with 3D printing for the first time?
My first introduction with 3D printing was back in 2007 when I was a PhD student at Virginia Tech. At the time, we were working on a research project with NASA Langley. And the research project was about design and simulation for a specific type of 3D printer that NASA Langley researchers developed. It was called electron beam free form fabrication. It was DED technology, direct energy deposition technology, and they needed a design and simulation platform to work with this technology to build stiffened panels, specifically used in aerospace structures. And so for that, Virginia Tech, Dr. Capania's research group, my advisor at Virginia Tech, they received funding from NASA to develop this platform. And that was my first introduction with 3D printing.
Okay, that's really cool because, like, that's a really relatively, well, kind of on the way, on one hand, very novel, very rare, but also very important 3D print platform, right? So it's a 3D printing platform that NASA is working on for a really long time, actually, on you know, right in space repair, in space manufacturing, and manufacturing stuff on the ground for use in space, right? So it's a very, very, very hardcore kind of introduction to 3D printing, I would think, right?
That's right. That's right. Yes. There were so many different capabilities that this additive manufacturing approach offered. One of them was, of course, printing in space. Another thing was that you could actually print large structures, which at the time wasn't the case with many 3D printers. Nowadays, there are different DED technologies that you can actually do that. But at the time, the built volume was very small. But with this technology, you could actually build a stiffened panel. And you could tailor the stiffness based on the performance of the part. And that was really important for the structural performance.
Okay, but that's really interesting because that's really close to the work you're doing now, so many years later, right?
Yes, it is. And that's what got me motivated to work on design for 3D printing, because what I noticed was that we have this technology, this advanced technology, and I could see that there are many hardware and material being built, being discovered, and being investigated. But then the design and simulation is not catching up. And so what I did after my PhD and postdoc, I became an assistant professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University Aerospace Engineering Department. And I started working on different 3D printing processes from FDM to DED to SLM, DLMS, depending on how you call it, and also different type of materials from continuous fiber to multi-metal that NASA JPL is working on. And then we built specific design technologies for each of these different 3D printer for the last 10, 11 years. And that was really important because I wanted to see for each 3D printer, we did something different than several other research groups that work on computational design. For every 3D printing process, we just didn't design. We designed, we printed the part, we did experimental testing, and then we compared the manufactured part and the manufactured part performance with what was designed to compare how the design was, how much different the tool path, for example, is with what we designed. And there is always some deviation, but how much it affected the final performance and how the performance was closed to what we designed for. And so that was my research in the last 11 years at Embry-Riddle.
But that's cool because that would also let you allow to per process and per material to explore kind of what the limitations are, what the feedback loops are, what affects what, right?
Exactly. Because right now we have like many different software for different things in industry. Like we have machine processing software, process monitoring software, print preparation software, design and simulation software, product management software, additive simulation software. So there are so many different software in industry being used right now in order to successfully 3D print a part that satisfies the performance requirement, but also manufacturing requirement. And it was really exciting to see how this works for different type of 3D printing process, because each 3D printer, they have their own type of material, they have their own print specifications, manufacturing process. So one design technology could not work for all of them. Right, it has to be 3D printing itself is like mass customization, is customized, and that's what the strength of 3D printing is. I believe the software for 3D printing should be similar. It should be customized for that 3D printer. But then we cannot have one software for every 3D printer, right? So how we can customize it, but then it could be under one platform.
I'm fascinated by this, that you've from like the first touch of 3D printing right up until now, have been working on exactly the same challenge, like laser focused on this and this idea. So when did you really for the first time say, okay, I've got a solution for this problem, or how did that solution come to you?
So it was back in 2020, we saw some interest from industry and we got curious that because I was working in academia and my connection, my network were all these professors and students. And so when we got this interest from industry, the question is why industry is interested? Like what's happening in industry? So that's when I dig deeper, that what's happening today in industry that they are interested in these design technologies. Why it doesn't exist right now, basically. So that's where I did some research to find out what currently exists and what doesn't. And then I got to the point that, okay, we have these design technologies. They can help industry to move forward with getting more efficient design, but also faster, because that's important. Time to market, as I learned, is very important. So how we can help product engineers to get to a better design faster? That was the question. But then the problem was that all of those design technologies were developed in the lab environment, which means, yes, we tried them for a couple of test cases, couple of studies, but that doesn't mean they were completely robust for general production. So we had to, so they were like basically TRL like 4, 5, 3, depending on different projects and how fundamental the project was. And then so now we had to take it from that TRL to a TRL that actually product engineers could use the technology, right? And that's a significant effort. And so first I was looking if anyone else would do it, right? If we could like provide all these algorithms and someone else would develop actually the platform. What we understood is because it is very, very time consuming, very effort consuming job, not everyone would be able to do that or would want to do that, would be interested to do that. And that's why I got interested to do it ourselves. And my former PhD student, he was so interested to do this too, because we didn't want these design technologies to just stay in journal article, just to stay theoretical in academia. We wanted someone actually to be able to use it.
But then you come to the point where, okay, I have to do it, but I have no experience in business, right? Was that a barrier for you? Did you think, okay, I need to read a book now? How did you solve that?
That's a very, very good question. So yes, first, when I was thinking, I said, okay, should we do it or should not? Because I don't have any business experience. And then the first question I got from one of our advisors and at the time, and he said, he asked me whether there are enough people that they wanted. And I interpreted that question like whether there is enough revenue, like whether you can survive. And I started searching, for example, additive manufacturing market cap. And then I went back with some numbers. I said, like, this is the market cap and this is... And he said, that's not the question. The question is whether someone today has serious problems that really they want to use this software and how many of them exist. And that's not a question you can sit in your office and answer that question, right? That's not an answer you can just Google. You need to talk to people. So that's what happened. We started talking to like 100, 120 product engineers, project manager. We even talked with like some software providers to see why they are not providing this solution, right? Because we didn't want to enter this and then find out someone else can actually do a better job. Why not just working with them, right? So we talk even with software company, we talk with 3D printing OEM, we talk with aerospace OEM, we talked with like biomedical, bio devices providers. And after that, what we learned is that there is a gap right now between design, simulation, slicing, and print, right? There is a gap, there are different functionalities, and there is a gap, which I can talk more about that gap, what that gap is. But then the question was, again, should we do it or not? And then I said, okay, I don't have any business experience, but we have technical experience, my PhD student and I, we have technical experience. Let's just build something, right? Let's just build something and provide it to user, like few, very few, and see how they work with this. And that doesn't require any investment, right? It's just a bunch of codes we put together. And then provide to user. And that's what we did. We worked with like three OEMs and two OEM and one contract manufacturer. And then we asked them to work with us on these designs, provide us a test case that they have every data about, how much time it took them to design it, what are the tool path, and then everything. The part is being used right now. And then we use our software, our codes basically, our algorithms, and then we provide the same thing. They don't need to tell us what their design is, what the time is, and everything. But we just want at the end to compare. And then that comparison gave us more insight how we should actually develop the software. Now, some of them said they want to purchase the software, but there was no software per se. There was just a bunch of codes, right? And we said, sure, why not? And we did that. And then with that, we went to investors and said, like, so there is a traction. There is an alpha version, if you may call it. And so we want to build this software. And that's where we raised our seed round. And so business for me was just like gradually learning. It wasn't something that I suddenly learned everything about business. I'm still learning, right? And I started reading a lot of books, right? Monetizing innovation, value proposition, writing a business canvas or putting together a business canvas, 0 to 1 from Peter Thiel. And so I read a lot of books, but the thing is that there is something more important than books. It's talking to those users, see what their challenges are. At the end, up to me, this business is about providing a useful tool to users, right?
Okay, that's super cool. Now, talk to us a little bit more like about this gap. What is the actual gap you're exploring?
So how Novaneer is different than any other software that today is available, any other generative design or in a broad sense CAE software. The first thing we observed when we provided these alpha version designs was that when they get the design, and that's something we didn't hear during the 120 interviews, but that's something we observed, that when they get this design, now they start changing it based on some of the requirements that we haven't even thought, right? And for that, and we provided them this STL, but the problem with STL is now you need to change it to STP, right? To a CAD model to change it. But if you do that, then you have thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of surfaces. And it's a nightmare basically to change that STP to something that you want, like changing one surface, it's basically one volume, right? And so they had to basically rebuild the design, right? They go back, rebuild the design because they wanted like fewer surfaces, something that they can actually change. And so what we did was, after we learned that wasn't our plan in the beginning, but after we learned that, we thought about how about we put some constraints in our design process that at the end, you get a design with topologically manageable features. So you don't get thousands of surfaces. Maybe you don't get that best performance if you have thousands of surfaces, but you have a reasonably good performance. But instead, you have a CAD model that now you can edit based on your requirement. So that's the first thing that is totally different. The second thing is that most journal articles, most software are focused on stiffness-based optimization. So we want to increase the stiffness. That's our goal. But the problem is that, and what's the reason for that? It's because a stiffness-based optimization is easy. Right, it's a convex problem, and the convergence is very fast. Strength based, on the other hand, is complicated. Right, so that's the reason most software or most journal articles are about stiffness. So what we thought, however, was, and what we saw with user is that what if this fails? If it fails, you can never reach that greater stiffness that you designed it for. So strength, stress is important. Another thing we observed was that most of this material that these 3D printers use, the properties are not isotropic. They're anisotropic. And that's actually an opportunity because you can use these anisotropic properties, you can use this capability that anisotropic properties provide to you, design the orientation locally so you can distribute the load efficiently throughout the structure. But that's not any software, that's not what any software we're using, right? And then from that, you can build the toolpath, right? So we included that in our software, and we designed the toolpath based on anisotropic properties and also based on the manufacturing constraint, like sharp turn, minimum length, right? So the software doesn't just do geometry optimization, it does geometry and toolpath optimization for isotropic or anisotropic properties, for stiffness and strength, providing a CAD model with manageable topological features. But then we saw another thing when we were working with our customer, that they need a high-end workstation to be able to do all of these things, right? They need 128 processors. A computer with 128 processor costs $9,000, $10,000, right? And for some, it was expensive, right? So we thought, okay, cloud is available and we can have on-demand processors, right? Like 128 processors on demand, it's not that expensive. So how about we develop the software there? And so that's another thing that we did. And the last thing, we used our educational background. We saw with some of these software that it takes a long time to learn the software and be able to use it. There are thousands of options and buttons everywhere. And we engineers love that, like to add buttons, to add complexity. But that's not what the user wants to do. The user has a job to do, right? To finish it efficiently, not go through hundreds of users. So we try to build a software that is very easy to follow, very straightforward, from point A to point Z, very easy to follow, and provide a 12-minute tutorial. So our goal from beginning was actually 10 minutes, then we increased it to 12 minutes, that with 12 minutes tutorial, you can provide all the inputs and you can get your project done in terms of your work. The rest of the work should be done by the software. So if it is additional 2 hours or 1 hour, it should be done by the software. Your time should be around like 10 to 12 minutes and you're done. So those are the five differences and five things that differentiates Novenir from other available software.
Okay, so what's the workflow essentially? So I've already designed my thing. That's the situation right now, right? I've made my thing in CAD, and we're talking about, you know, your focus on, you know, lots of surfaces, that kind of thing. You're talking about models with a lot of complexity. That's really the thing you're shooting for as well, right?
Yes. So as I mentioned, there are in various levels that what we are offering. So yes, you start with CAD, but you don't design in CAD. What you do is that you have a CAD model, so you know what is the overall volume that you have available for the part that you want to design, right? And it's just that we call it design domain, right? And for example, if you want to design a torque link, as we showed in our website, right? You have the design volume, so you know how much space you have available. And that's it. And your job is done in CAD. Then you take that CAD model, and that CAD model usually is pretty straightforward, right? That CAD model is not that complicated usually. What happens is after you design it, it becomes complicated with other generative design software. So what we do is that you provide that CAD model to our software, and then we provide you some materials, because anisotropic properties, we are talking about 19 properties. That's hard to get, right? Usually OEMs, some provide, some do not provide all these 19 properties. So it's hard to dig into a lot of documents to find all of them. We did include some of them in our software. So you can just select the material and everything will be populated for you. Then you tell us which part you want us to design and which part should stay as it is right now, right? Because they are important for assembly. And then after that, you apply the load, you mesh the part, and you enter your manufacturing constraints, right? For example, you are using this 3D printer. What is the minimum turn? What is the filament length? You provide those information. At what orientation you want it to be printed? You provide those information, and then you press design, and the design is provided to you. Now, the design can be slightly modified, so you can take it back to your CAD, and because it doesn't have thousands of surfaces, you can actually modify it. This torquing we showed, you can modify it in 20 minutes, right? So you modify the CAD in 20, 30 minutes, and then take it back to our software because you didn't change it very much. Then the toolpath that we originally designed stay the same almost. Now you can get the toolpath, just hit a start slicing, you get the toolpath. So at the end of this process, you have toolpath for every layer, and then you have also the optimized geometry.
So, and what's the quantifiable result? I mean, what is the, like, do I save time? It seems like time, right? I mean, do you have any idea how much time I save? Like, you know, what are the benefits of this? Like, as in how much time I save or how much better the part is, that kind of thing? Can you share something
yes,
like that?
Yes, absolutely. So we did our experiment with different software, but more importantly, we observed our user. Like, how did they do this before, right? What did they do before and how they did it and how much time it took? That's the test cases that we tried with different OEMs. On average, what we observed was that around 60% reduced time, around 50% better in performance. Those are the two major effect of this software. So less time by about 60% and better performance of the part performance by about 50%. Also, you don't need a great computer, of course, because it's running on the cloud. And there is no steep learning curve, right? So there is not a lot of time that product engineer needs to spend to learn the software. They can start in 12 minutes to do their project.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds really solid, especially since, you know, their engineering, you know, the additive manufacturing engineers that do exist, let's say there's very few of them and their time is quite valuable. So that seems like a really, really kind of interesting constraint. But, and also, like, okay, but part performance improvement, like you said, 50%. So
yes.
That means that, like, I can make a part and you can give me a part that is like 30, 40% stronger than what I came up with.
That's what we showed for some test cases in our published journal article. So it is reviewed by reviewers. We showed that you can get 50% better performance if you just, for example, if you don't use anisotropic properties, or if you don't develop the toolpath, don't design the toolpath. We showed that if you don't do those things versus using non-linear design technology, there is a 50% improvement in stiffness or strength, depending on what you are designing for.
But now you're focused on only, like, you don't do everything, right? I can't just throw every part at you, right, at the moment. Or you know, you're focused on certain really specific technology right now, right?
Yes. So in terms of the geometry design, you can design any geometry, but the expectation must be realistic, right? So first of all, you need to know your design domain, right? And then second, if you are going to 3D print it, yeah, we can provide you the toolpath, but are they realistic? Like for the built volume, for example, that you have, or for support structures, or for there are many things that play into actually manufacturing the part. That segment, that focus is left to the user, right? But in terms of designing the geometry, it can be any geometry, isotropic, anisotropic, metal or composite 3D printer or polymer 3D printer. And but in terms of the toolpath, right now it's the toolpath are basically for FDM, right? So Of course, if you want to print it with a metal 3D printer, like DLMS, for example, you can use the STL that we provide, or you can get the STP modified and then change it to STL and print the part. But the toolpath that we provide right now is specifically designed for FDM.
Okay, and how do you hope to get customers? What's the path to getting new clients and stuff like that?
So we are still learning. I mean, we do have some users right now that they are using the software and they will be using the software, but we are gonna have more users. So we are and we want to learn from them. So right now we are providing a free trial to a selected. So we have a wait list. So to a selected number of users, we provide a free trial. The reason that it is selected is because we want to learn from them. We want to understand them. And we are only four, five people, right? And so there are so much support we can provide. And we want to provide a great support to those users. That's why the number of users are selective. And then they can request free trial. It is in our website, Novenir free trial. And then we go through the user's background, every user's, and see what they want to get out of Novenir, and see if whether we can provide that benefit to them, or the current version provides that benefit to them. And if it does, then great, we provide the access, and then we really appreciate their feedback, because their feedback will shape the future of Novenir and which direction we will go.
You know, and how do you see this developing? I mean, do you think that a lot of people do this, or only people at large aerospace firms? Like, you know, how do you see your company growing?
So I think at the company, what we have seen is, or what we have talked with those, when we talked with those people, we have seen users from companies with different size, from small size to medium size to large size. I think at this stage, probably our focus is more like small and medium sized companies to use this software, to provide us feedback. And then at later stage, probably we can also discuss it with more, with larger OEM, aerospace OEM, or biodevice OEM, or energy sector, auto sectors, and to see how this software can be useful for what they are doing right now.
Yeah, so first off, like you know, what are some of the things? I know a lot of stuff happened, and a lot of stuff you're doing you can't really talk about, kind of. But what you know, are there some exciting ideas or some exciting hypotheticals where you think that Novenir can really make a difference? Like,
yes, so we recently actually received an NSF SBIR grant, and that's where we are going to do a lot of research. So there are three areas that we are focused. One area is to expand the functionality. We are focused on stiffness, strength. Right now, it is kind of multi-material, but it is not multi-material in the sense that sometimes industry use. So for example, as I mentioned, NASA JPL right now, they have this 3D printer that they can print, for example, stainless steel and Invar, right? So one of them with a very, very good stiffness, not very good, but reasonably good stiffness. The other one with great thermal expansion, and they can both metal in one part, right? And that's what I'm saying about multi-material. So that's one thing that we will expand. Another thing is that right now we have a couple of manufacturing constraints, but that is not enough for every 3D printer. That's why we need to work with more OEMs to include their manufacturing constraints in the design process. That's the second thing that we are focused on. And the third thing is that enhancing this optimized geometry that we provide. As I mentioned before, is that you can get the best performance with a very complicated structure, right? Is that what the user wants? That's what we want to learn. Is that what the user wants? Or the user wants something that doesn't have that best performance because of all the constraints that we put in the design process, but the performance is reasonable, is much better than the current design that you have, right? But instead, it is editable. Right, so you can actually edit it, and you can change it based on your requirement. So these are the three focus that we have. One is expanding the functionality in terms of the objective functions and in terms of what type of material we can use. Second is manufacturing constraints, from support structure to other manufacturing constraints depending on different 3D printing process. And three, enhancing the optimized geometry that right now we provide to the user.
Okay, but then How do you see yourself competing? Is this something that you know, you're having a rather mature audience, like very few people have it, and it's just an addition to their package? Or do you hope to be a primary design tool, but then for a really specific market? Or yeah, you just don't know yet who is going to use your product how?
Yeah, our goal really right now is to, our competition is with the challenges that we see the product engineers have, right? And how our technology and our research, prior research, can help to solve those challenges, right? In terms of the vision that we have for Novenir is that it's a design hub, right? That for various manufacturing process, the product engineers can log in, they can design the part. The part we understand you can never get, or most probably you are not going to get a perfect part, not just using Novenir, with any other software. That's why product engineers need to continue working on the part. But we provide a useful part to them that they can actually work on it, and they don't have to put many hours, like 40, 50 hours, to rebuild it again and to work on it, right? So they can get an efficient design. They can get a good design for various 3D printing process, for various material, with a reasonably effort and reasonable time. And at the end, they can kind of communicate with the software, right? They can modify the part. They can make it a little bit, change the toolpath, change the geometry, change the material, and they can quickly do this smart iteration, right? So they are involved in the process. It's not just hands off, right? But still, they are not putting a lot of time to go through this process.
And in terms of like, what are the applications where you're the most excited about? If you're thinking about this, what are some things? I mean, space has got to be really exciting for you, but so, and you know, are there specific parts in space where you're really excited or would be really excited about using with this?
Yes, space, for example, drone application is exciting. We have seen some application, and then generally aerospace, probably they are using 3D printing more than any other industry. I mean, healthcare, you can see also the use of 3D printing, but aerospace is probably what is driving the, especially for the larger part, bigger built volume. So that's what we are excited, but that doesn't mean we are just focused on aerospace. We are also working with bio device companies, see how they can use this software for their part. And later we plan to go also to auto industry, to also energy sector, right? So anyone who is working on getting high performance design efficiently, those are people we want to talk with them and see how this software can be useful to them. It may or may not be at this stage, but we want to learn from them how we can further develop it. If it is not useful at this stage, how we can further develop it, that it can be useful to them in long term. So our focus is high performance part, getting to that high performance part efficiently, less design time.
And in terms of the business itself, like do you plan to go for another funding round, or are you like trying to get to profitability as fast as you can? What's the plan there?
Our goal right now at this stage for the next 5-6 months is just learning from our user. What we learned during our interview is that they are paying a lot for some of this software, right? And we see the other software provider in other area, not specifically mechanical engineering, aerospace structure, but generally infrastructure as a service, for example, they are kind of adapting to the user. But we do see that in technical software, in mechanical engineering, aerospace engineering, but we haven't seen it very often. Maybe we are moving in that direction, but we haven't seen it very often. We need to have this dynamic cost, right? Because especially for a small size, a medium size company, they cannot pay a large amount upfront for a software that they don't know how much they are going to use, right? So we need to have this dynamic pricing that the user can use based on the number of projects they have, like how many parts they are designing, how many parts they are 3D printing, right? And then they can go up and down based on what they're using. That's what AWS or Azure are doing, right? Infrastructure as a service or platform as a service. They have this dynamic pricing and price per use. Or cost per use. Software as a service, most of the time you see in other areas, they are like this, but in technical software, right, sometimes we don't see that opportunity that the user actually pay as they need, right? So they don't pay a huge upfront cost. They may pay some upfront cost, but not a huge upfront cost. And then they use the software, and then if their use is a lot, they pay more. If they use less, they pay less, right? That's what we want to learn from user. Is that model a model that's appealing to them? Or a different model is appealing? So that's why the next 5-6 months is very important to understand the product market fit, right? And after that, of course, we go for another round of funding. But that's when we build a user base. We completely understand what is the business model, how we want to charge user, and how we interact with user, what is the customer relationship, how it looks like, how we reach those users, right? Whether through distributors, whether we work with some of these OEMs to distribute the software, or we directly go to the user. Those are the things that we are going to learn within the next 5 months. So we are tailoring our product market fit. And based on that, our goal is to go for the next round of funding sometimes by the end of this year, 2024.
Let's talk a little bit more broadly about aerospace. I mean, I think if we look about aerospace, now we're seeing a lot of stuff in new space and propulsion, you know, to really optimize structures and to see integrated functionality. What do you think is driving the adoption of additive for aerospace at the moment?
Actually, I asked this question from some aerospace companies. I got multiple different answers. Sometimes the reason they are using 3D printing, additive manufacturing, it's because the labor cost. The labor cost with conventional manufacturing is too high. So it's not necessarily they want to change the design. It's just like the assembly and everything related to that is costly. So they are going after almost the same design, but with lower labor cost. That's one thing. And another thing is, of course, optimizing the performance. That's what we see a lot in specifically, I have seen in aerospace structure and in biomedical application. Because in both of them, you need to improve the performance. In aerospace structure, I think it's pretty clear. The weight is the enemy, right? So you need to bring it down. And in order to bring it down, you need a part that provides you the same performance, maybe even better performance, and reducing the weight by at least 20 to 25% to motivate the aerospace companies to use this different manufacturing approach, if the cost makes sense. And for patient-specific implant or biodevices, it's the same story, right? Because when you provide this implant, it depends on the anatomy. Off-the-shelf implant may or may not work, right? And so you need to tailor the implant based on the anatomy, and the anatomy is not just the shape, but also the bone density, for example. And that's where, again, you need a high performance. And when I say high performance, I mean performance tailored, not necessarily high performance, but performance tailored part for patient-specific implant. So that's another reason that I have seen aerospace or biomedical companies, they use 3D printing. And the third reason is, of course, customization. Right, which is pretty popular in fashion industry, jewelry, and also sport equipment, right, and mass customization, which I think is going to be a new trend. Probably, I mean, it's already a trend, but it's probably going to be more powerful in future.
Yeah, mass customization is always something that you know, be warned. I've been trying to do mass customization projects with companies since around 2009, 2010. Mm-hmm. And it's been really, really tough going from, like, you know, everybody's really enthusiastic, but ultimately very little actually happens. So it's the once in future king, you know?
Yes. And there was a lot of hype about 3D printing, mass customization, and what 3D printing can achieve. I think what's going to happen is that the technology, and there are a lot of technologies. I mean, imagine when composite came to aerospace industry. How long did it take until a plane with the majority of the parts made of composite was actually built, right? It took about 30 years, right? 30
yeah,
years
Dreamliner, from the Dreamliner, right? Yeah, excuse Dreamliner, right?
Yes,
yeah.
Dreamliner.
That was the Dreamliner.
Yes. Yeah. And so 30 years, right? And that, because the technology had to mature enough, a lot of certification, right, material data and design, and the right design and simulation tool, manufacturing data, a lot of testing, right, needed to happen until we get there. So I think that's usually happened with the new technology. Same thing is happening with AI. We expect that tomorrow it's going to change everything, right? That's not usually the story. It's going to happen usually gradually, right? Gradually, you will see that first, for example, you have AI-assisted technology, not AI-driven, right? Because AI-driven requires a lot of data. So you have AI-assisted, and then gradually you move to AI-driven functionalities, right? Same thing happened with 3D printing. When it came, there was a lot of hype, and now gradually we are going through all of this process from testing to material data, manufacturing data, certification, to get to actually production component and use parts rather than the prototype or sometimes tooling.
And for this kind of stuff, I mean, if you're going forward, you know, what would hasten the adoption? You think, of course, software, but are there other stuff that you think we need to happen if we want to make the stuff like go quicker?
Yes. As I mentioned before, a unified platform for the software need to happen. We cannot ask you. I have seen product engineers using 4 different software, right, for 3D printing a part. And it's not just the cost for each software, right? That could be significant. A steep learning curve can actually be an issue, right? And another reason is that the functionalities of these different software, so for example, machine processing software or process monitoring software, print preparation, design simulation, these functionalities are interconnected, right? You cannot design and then suddenly decide, now I want to put toolpath on this complicated lattice structure, right? Like composite, for example, filament, on this complicated, a lot of thin members lattice structure. When you were designing, you had to think about it, not after you got the final design. Or after you get the final design, now you think how the additive part is going to happen. So additive simulation, then now you do additive simulation. It needed to happen when you were designing the part. So there are interconnectivity. We need to have a unified, more like unified platform, seamless workflow and reducing timing for training and the cost, of course, for these different software. That's another issue. Again, 4 different software, 4 different costs. That's probably not a good idea, right? Improving printer-specific customization. That's another area that I think industry will work on, right? So instead of building a generic algorithm or platform, how about we tailor it to different, so the user can choose different software and different 3D printer, and the platform will be tailored toward that printer. And another thing, of course, is AI. AI is definitely going to play an important role for all of these functionalities that I talked about. It's just we need to be careful that what we expect from AI. AI requires a lot of data, a lot of training, right? And there is no large data set right now, right? For any of those things that I mentioned, there is no large data set. So there is no AI-driven functionality for those functionalities I talked about. There could be AI-assisted, but not AI-driven. There are different things. Sometimes when people use computer and algorithm, they call it AI. Right? This is AI-based, for example, software, right? That might be true because it's an intelligent and it's artificial, but that's not what people think. When they think about AI, they think probably about machine learning. They think you are using a large data set. So it's not a pre-programmed algorithm. It is an algorithm that works based on a large data set and keep adapting and learning.
Okay, that sounds very, very sensible. And what about, you know, generative design? We've heard so much about that. And then it kind of, yeah, every single time, it's the answer to everything, and then it goes quiet. And what do you think of that?
Yeah, generative design is very important because, again, as I mentioned before, there are like 3 different areas that I have seen companies, the reason companies probably come to 3D printing, the labor cost and the high performance part and customizing the part based on the needs. And for at least 2 out of those 3, you need generative design software. Right, you need generative design software to get high performance part. Otherwise, there is a lot of trial and error. But again, the generative design software must be based on the manufacturing constraints and the material properties that you intend to use. Sometimes generative design software can be interpreted as a generic generative design software, right? that's maybe previously it was okay, we could have that, and then that was fine. But now we need to go to the next generation, right? The next generation should be a customized generative design software, right? That it works for your manufacturing process, for your material, for your need, basically. It's customized for your need. And it's not a generic software that you can just go inside without thinking about the actual material properties that you have or actual printing process that you have. And it suddenly magically provides you the result. We are not there yet. Maybe one day we will, but we are not there yet. It's not that smart to guess what you want, right? You need to provide the information, the material, the manufacturing constraints, what 3D printer you are using, how you are going to 3D print this. The generative design should be based on those data. What I'm seeing is that you get the design through generative design, and then after that, now it's your responsibility to think about it, how you want to print it, what material actually you're using, what are the manufacturing constraints that you have. Now try to change it based on all those constraints that you have. That shouldn't be the case. Those parameters should be inside the generative design algorithm, not at the end of the generative design algorithm.
Okay. That sounds a very, very lucid kind of approach. Hey, Ollie, thank you so much for your time today. It was really wonderful.
Thank you very much, Joris, for having me.
And thank you guys for listening to another episode of the 3D Pod. My name is Joris Peels, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
You've been listening to the 3D Pod. For more information on what you just heard or to subscribe, visit www.3dprint.com or follow us at 3dprint_com.